Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Yannis Papadakis, business development manager at CREXI and today's host. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome, and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that cater to commercial real estate newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Yannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI. And today we are thrilled to sit down with Drew Brenneman, founder of Brenneman Capital. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. A natural born entrepreneur, Drew started his first business at 14 years old. He then launched a highly successful internet business while in high school. His ambition to find the best investment vehicle for his earnings from his internet business led to him to real estate, purchasing his first two rental properties at 19 years old. His drive attracted the attention of HGTV, where Drew was featured as an up-and-coming real estate investor. He wanted to share what he had learned and aspired to provide others direct real estate ownership opportunities. Drew earned his BBA in Real Estate and Urban Land Economics from the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Wisconsin School of Business, one of the top real estate programs in the nation. Upon graduation, he worked for three national real estate development firms, each focusing on different product types, affording him a broad knowledge base for office, retail, market-rate multifamily, and affordable multifamily sectors. In 2005, he founded Brenneman Capital, specializing and expanding their presence in value-add multifamily in Chicago, Phoenix, Dallas, Austin, over the last several years. Drew, welcome to the podcast. I've got to ask, what was the internet business that you started?
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here. I just had Bob Knackel on my podcast and saw he was on yours. So it's happy to be joining. The internet business, it was just something I sort of fell into. You know, it wasn't quite Facebook or Google or anything, but it was this would have been in like 2003, 2002, and people that were, let's say, my age, high schoolers, were playing these online video games. So Diablo 2, EverQuest, World of Warcraft, those were what everybody was playing. And people started paying real money for items in those games, but outside of the game. So let's say you played and then you had acquired items and you were going to quit, you could go on eBay and sell your stuff. And so that's what I did. I basically just was a middleman reseller of sorts, where someone would quit, I'd buy it from them on the cheap, and then I'd put it up on eBay on a buy it now at sort of top of the market pricing, and then wait for it to sell. And on any one sale, I didn't make a ton of money, but it was just, I ended up doing quite a few transactions in a 4-year period. I did almost 10,000 sales. And so even if you made, $10 each, on average, that's $100,000. And that's about what I made, somewhere between 80 and 100,000. As a high schooler. So, and then that's why I started thinking about investing. So
RMTs, real money transactions for MMOs. That's impressive. You know, you were really, really ahead of the curve there, seeing as now most games have microtransactions built into them.
Impressive. Right place, right time of sorts where, if I was born 10 years later, I would have had to do something different. I'd have to be drop shipping on Amazon or something, just whatever the next thing would have been.
Right. And then what was the first investment that you bought with your hard-earned gains?
So in real estate, the first deal I bought was a duplex. So I went to college at UW-Madison, like you had mentioned, and I was from the Milwaukee area. So I already kind of knew what Madison was like and figured, I had read about the stock market and all sorts of different things to invest in and just really liked what real estate offered. And so I figured, why waste any time? So when I was a freshman, I got a realtor and I bought my first duplex. So, and then I moved into that my sophomore year and then rented out the bedrooms in the unit I lived in and then rented out the upstairs unit to just to two guys that were also going to college.
Nice. Well, we just covered your background, but I'd briefly like to learn more about your career path and kind of lessons that you learned along the way. how did you first get your start in commercial real estate? I mean, aside from buying your initial deal, how did you first your start into practicing commercial real estate?
So to me, the start was with the duplex and kind of everything just built from there. So I did major in real estate at UW-Madison. And so that originally I was thinking maybe I should be a doctor or do something else, but I really liked just looking at that duplex and kind of how that deal looked and thought this is what I should be majoring in. It's what I'm almost picking as a hobby. Why not pick that as a career? And so in college, I ended up buying 4 properties total, about $2 million a property. And after graduation, you know, I had already invested all my money across those 4 deals. And then I was thinking, what should I do next? And I started working at a developer up in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis. And while I was working there, I met one of the interns there. He had heard, I had told him what I was doing, just telling him kind of similar story to now. And he said, why don't we go talk to my dad? Maybe all of us could buy property together. We could look at something. Maybe he'd want to invest. And you know, what's interesting too is that the intern, he also majored in real estate at Madison and was working at a real estate company. So, you know, there's a lot of people that were already kind of in, like, that he had met that were doing real estate. And it never dawned on me, but someone had asked, why do you think you guys connected? And it was probably because I was the only one who was like doing any deals, like outside of work or on my own, where everyone else, it would have been like an idea. But instead I already had activity. I already had bought properties. I, you know, had a proof of concept. I had bought 4 deals, had already sold 2 of them at significant profits. And so, you know, we met with the dad, I showed him that, and then he liked a $3 million building. And so when you say, how did you get to me, that was the first commercial deal. So that was a 2-tenant shopping center in the Uptown neighborhood in Minneapolis, asking $3 million at the end of 2008. So of course we're the only bidders on it. So we wrote our own price essentially and bought that at, at around $2.5 million, and was almost a 9 cap at the time. And we were borrowing at 6. So the cash on cash was pushing 20% a year. So we're thinking, yeah, things could maybe get worse with the economy. But we got 2 7-year leases with, and one of the tenants is, you know, basically bulletproof. It was Verizon Wireless. Why not just let's go? We're getting paid to wait, high cash flow, pay the loan down, and this eventually it'll go up, and we'll do better than that. And so, as simple as that sounds, that was the first commercial deal I did, and then we were, we sort of just rinse and repeat. Did the same thing, and from 2009 to 2011, we were doing, I'd say, value add to kind of just mispriced, stabilized commercial deals, but it was all commercial. We weren't doing any multifamily together because there wasn't any distress really in it, or at least there was distress, but the deals that were, you know, the best ones to pick off at that time in the Twin Cities, it was the commercial ones. So those had the most motivated sellers. A lot of the apartment deals, they would be for sale, but then they still had like a Fannie loan on them with a good fixed rate for another 5 years. So they weren't really in distress like maybe a commercial owner whose loan ended and they got other buildings that are under construction or are half full because they lost a couple tenants and then they just want to dump their one really good one. And then we had fresh capital that we were investing so that we didn't have any legacy deals to worry about. And then in 2013, we started buying multifamily. And so I had relocated in 2011 to Chicago, and we started doing multifamily. And pretty much since then, it wasn't a real conscious decision until recently, but since 2013, we've basically only been doing multifamily. You know, we had bought a couple shopping centers still in the Twin Cities in 2015 and in 2019. But then in 2021, we sort of just announced like we're just only doing multifamily. So kind of as we did more multifamily, we got better and better at it, and we noticed opportunities better. And I actually was just talking to somebody today about a deal we're buying, and he was asking, why does the seller not know you can raise the rents to what we're planning on doing? And it's because we own the best comp in the neighborhood, and like that's information we have because we're in the market, we own it. I don't know if they have that info,
right?
Like we do, because we already have it. So if we are from out of town or we're investing in every product type in that neighborhood, doing retail and office and apartments, like you wouldn't be as good at it. So we eventually realized we should specialize in multifamily, and that's where we find ourselves today. So,
got it. Wow. What a path. Were there some lessons that you learned early on that you found were invaluable moving forward? I mean, they can be, let's call them favorite mistakes or something that may have course corrected you onto the current path that you said, you know what, you know, not this, you know, maybe I got burned with a deal that was outside of this product type. You know, what do you think helped shape that path for you?
Well, I noticed that it seemed like the people that were doing multifamily, they had the steadiest trajectory upward in terms of their portfolio and everything, where a lot of the developers or investors that were doing for sale things like condos or single family homes or some commercial product types like retail, office, that it was seemed very up and down. And then I went back and looked at some NCREIF data back in 2020, and they have a private index where they have all the returns by product type. And from 1990 to 2020, the highest returns were in multifamily and also the least volatility. And that's measured over a bunch of different hold periods, 3, 5, 7 year, 10 year hold periods, different combinations within that 20 year span. So I sort of was noticing that. And then, that data kind of backed it up. And then, you know, the specialization thing is probably the best tip, I guess. And I already, you know, had dived into that. And then also too, we kept it very simple, which I think people can overcomplicate things and make their deals really, really complicated and have pref equity and a real complicated waterfall and a big different fee structure and co-GPs and guarantors and all this different stuff. And we kept it super simple. It was just the three of us buying properties, with that father mostly investing all the equity needed, and then me and the son doing the work. So I think just don't be afraid to keep it simple. I know you see things and there's a lot of jargon being thrown around and terminology and you know, but it's, you know, you can start out too just doing a duplex and keep it simple and just kind of work your way up. You know, well, that's one thing that I realized kind of looking back.
Nice. Now, moving on to our topic for today, you know, covering your unique perspective as a multifamily investor, can you provide some context? You know, what is Brenneman Capital? What's your team's investment ethos and your mission?
Yeah, so we focus on just multifamily and just, you know, certain types of multifamily. So we're buying only deals that are built or renovated after 1980 and then only in Chicago, Phoenix, Dallas, and Austin. And then within that, we only do a couple different profiles of deals where we're only buying in the $5 to $50 million deal size. And we're only doing core plus deals. So those are, you know, newer vintage properties where, you know, they have high return potential relative to the execution risk, but you're not doing a lot of capital improvements. You're not doing renovations. Usually your value add or your outsized returns are coming from something like a loan assumption, mismanagement, or just marking the rents to market. That's been our most common deal, especially the ones in Chicago. A lot of stuff coming out of the 2009-10 era, just buildings built to be condos, didn't sell, and then they went into foreclosure, picking those up cheaply where we didn't need to do a heavy renovation. It was a newer building. And then also we do, you know, the second bucket that we do is this traditional value add, acquire a building built, you know, like in the 1980s, 1990s that needs some level of renovation. So, we've spent a lot of time on, our team and technology. So, you know, one thing that we, you know, kind of coming out of 2005 to 2020, for the most part, it was just me and one other guy just doing the deals as partners. And then as I started looking around the country at what was happening, and these other markets were doing better than the Midwest, you know, it's no surprise where Phoenix and Florida and Texas and these markets where they were doing a lot better, but to cover new ground, I knew I needed to staff up. And then, so I did that. I hired, some additional acquisitions guys in 2021. And, one of them came from a $50 billion private equity company, and he had a lot of, he was really great analytically. And, he at that company, he redid their underwriting model, and it was a project they did during the pandemic. And we use the same model, but have improved it since. And then we have a market outlook model that we made where same guy, his hobby is analytics, like for sports. So he made a NCAA predictive bracket optimization model is the name. So it can 5x your results in your NCAA brackets in the tournament for basketball. And so he figured out what's correlated with winning and losing, and then the different based on how the team performs on those, he can weight them against each other and predict the outcomes. And so we did this.
How accurate is it?
You can 5x your results. So let's say you're in a 100-person pool, doesn't mean you're going to win, but let's say your chance normally was 1%, now it's 5%. And so, he's able to backtest it, which is interesting because he goes, okay, based on prior matchups, prior games, what's actually correlated with winning and losing? And so and we did a podcast on mine on this a couple years ago. And I forgot what the highest correlated things were with winning, but it wasn't what you would think. Like at that time, you know, Golden State and the NBA's winning every championship and, you know, the most dominant team, it seems like, but three-pointers wasn't actually the thing that was the most correlated. It was the pace of play. And so like if you think about them, they also play very fast. And so that was very critical. But also how that matched up with the other team and then also turnover. So we did the same thing for multifamily across the country and figured out what's most correlated with multifamily price appreciation, which if people want to know, it was job growth and population growth as a percentage, you know, not just the raw numbers. So then one of our target markets, Austin, you know, that's number one in the country for both job growth and population growth on a trailing five-year average across like the last 20 years, has been number one. Two standard deviations like beyond the national average, where that's been so we have just a ton of technology, and then where this tools that we didn't have before, so that gives us a real edge like in what we're doing, where we have the underwriting model, we have our market appreciation model, we created an investment database where from our model we click a button and it pulls 900 variables out of each deal and then puts it in a database, so then we can compare how do we underwrite the last one. So then we go, okay, you can look at every line item for expenses or rent growth or whatever assumption you want to drill into and see that it was underwritten the same way, or go back and look, where did this one sell? How was that underwritten? What was the return that they accepted? And then two, we invest a lot in relationships where 80% of the deals that we've bought have been either off market or through a repeat broker or through a repeat seller or some combination of that. You know, across the 40 or so deals that I bought, only two of them have been one of those best and final kind of scenarios where you're, you know, multiple rounds of bidding. And so that in one of those, that was like right before Labor Day weekend and everyone was checked out, so it was a little sleepy for a best and final. But yeah, so that's really what we've been doing in terms of trying to develop the company, because I think really, like, you know, any sort of investing business is competitive, and you want to think, what's your edge? And, you know, that can be different things. And so we've figured out for us, what works best is having that specialization. So we're over time, just keep getting better and better at what we're doing and have that sort of insider's info, if you will. And then team, technology, relationships, just really investing heavily in that. Then you're going to produce better returns, better results compared to just, you know, trying to just buy the best deal across the whole country and not really having any given expertise or edge on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. So I'm interested now if you could talk a little bit about how your strategy may have shifted as you're growing larger, you know, in terms of, it takes obviously, you know, a bigger team, different skills, you know, tech to go from, you know, your first deal to, you know, your 30th, as you mentioned earlier. You know, how has that strategy changed and grown, you know, over the years as you've been managing this?
Yeah, it's funny. It really hasn't, you know, a lot of people, they'll say, you know, these doing a $30 million deal is the same amount of work as a $3 million one, or it's just as hard. And there's a lot of truth to that, you know, where, so they're actually, you know, not a lot has changed in terms of what we like do day to day, I feel like, where I think the doing the $30 million deal is a lot harder than the $3 million deal, but it's not that much harder. So people that are doing $3 million deals, like they could, if they're able to put, you know, raise the equity, qualify for the debt, like they would be able to do these larger deals. And a lot of that's just kind of has to do with the relationships that you have and then kind of what you believe is your, you know, your skill set at that point. So, I mean, what's changed is the workload is a lot bigger, you know, where if you're going to look in, let's say, four markets compared to just one, which would have been the difference between now and 10 years ago, you're covering a lot more ground. You're traveling, you're underwriting more deals. There's four times as many brokers to know and owners and markets to understand. So I think really just the main difference is just the workload expanding and making sure that you can handle that. But once we have a deal under contract, I mean, I'm still reviewing due diligence. I'm still working on the contract. It's still the same. People are touching every aspect of it. So I think, I'm still pitching the deal to investors. And it hasn't changed that much other than just there's more ground to cover. So you're not, I'm not the one able to field every call from a broker. Or I don't underwrite every deal anymore, I haven't underwrote a deal in a couple of years now, where before until 2019, I underwrote every deal. So it was a big, That's been the biggest change. So you got to rely on the people you hire and, delegate things and, believe they can do it. And, obviously monitor if they can't do it, you can't be relying on them, but,
Yeah. And then, just quickly, I'd love to hear a little bit about your management strategy in terms of, how you've built your company up for self-sufficiency.
Yeah. In terms of, for property management, or what kind of management are you thinking?
Yeah. Property management.
Yeah. And I think so. We've done it at this point every way: owner managed, third party, some, partnering with somebody. And so what's, what works best is, I feel like if we are directly the property manager, so like we in the Minnesota deals I was referring to, the ones we still own there, and all the Chicago ones, except for a couple, we self-manage. And so that if you're close to the properties, have people there and everyone knows what they're doing, you can get a better result doing that. But a lot of times you enter a new market, you don't know what the laws are, you don't know what the norms are, and that's something potentially that's a good thing to delegate out if you can find a good enough manager. And so we
and then just to interject here, what makes a good enough manager, right? Like, what are you looking for in a third party?
Yeah, and that's it would be hard to just run down a list, really, because what's interesting, and I will try to get some actionable insights here, I guess, on that. But like, it's just having done this for a while, because I started out managing those duplexes on my own. Then I hired a third party company. Then we were managing those commercial properties ourselves and the Chicago apartments ourselves. And then, I guess we know what to look for, what an answer is, where it's like they know what they're talking about. To me, it's like really apparent in like a 1 hour call, just kind of asking, how much does this cost? How do you staff this? How do you do leasing? What do you use for accounting? So we're asking all those questions. But I think if someone was like new in a market and trying to figure out what we're talking about now, I think the best way is just to try to get referrals and then have those, 1 hour phone calls or meetings where you can ask them every question you can think of. And then just try to run through all the different, things you're going to run into. How much does payroll cost? What do you guys use for this? What's your accounting? But really, I think just use the, relying on the referrals. Like if other owners are happy with them, like I think put a lot of weight on that. And then as you're, you can, evaluate for yourself once you're using them, once you have an actual deal. But especially if you're new, it's going to be hard to know what to look for because you maybe haven't managed property yourself. So personally, I believe, especially starting out as an investor, you should manage all your own properties to know what that all entails. And people who have done that can tell when they're talking to an owner or someone in the business who has not managed properties before, where they're asking things that just don't seem realistic that's important. And then that way, what you're hiring out, and then you can tell, compare that to yourself. So if, in Minnesota and Chicago, we like doing it ourselves, for the most part. But then in Chicago, we found a management company we also like. So a couple deals we passed off to them that didn't really fit weren't in like our exact usual niche. And then in Phoenix, we have two different companies we've been using, one that's really good at like 100+ unit deals, and then one that's better for the ones that are under 100 where no people work at them. So, that's just some of your trial and error and just experience, I guess. So.
Got it. Well, moving to today, let's talk a little bit about the current market and some of the shifts that, you've had to navigate in, our current market circumstances, 2023. You know, what are your thoughts on the current state of the multifamily market, either nationally or in your focus markets?
Yeah, I think the multifamily market's pretty different depending on where you're looking at across the country. Where, let's say, starting with the Midwest, like that did not boom nearly as much as the Sun Belt, and things never really got overheated there. And so, like in our Chicago deals, from 2021 to 2022, we had probably on average 6-8% rent growth, and then this last year, 2022 to 2023, a similar amount. And so things are still running well in a lot of the Midwest cities. And so the only sort of distress you're seeing there would just be all interest rate related. You know, the operating costs haven't really moved that much. All the concerns about insurance. I mean, that's the costs for insurance are going up everywhere, but that's falling a lot more on a lot of these Sunbelt states like Texas and Florida and elsewhere. And so I think, so the Midwest, it's strong and there wasn't a lot of floating rate borrowing. I don't know if it's like a cultural thing almost, but like everyone I know in Chicago, they just do 5-year fixed loans, 10-year fixed loans, where I don't know a single person who did a floating rate loan in the Midwest, not a single one. I mean, I know they exist obviously and people did them, but I personally know nobody that did that. And then in the Sun Belt, everybody that I know, they only did floating rate. So it's I think there's the next 1 or 2 years for multifamily. I think probably across the country, except for maybe in the Midwest, I think it's going to be, I think there's more pain to go. Like a lot of properties were bought with the 3-year floating rate bridge loans in 2021 and in 2022. And if you look, if interest rates don't change and you need to refinance your, a loan that was sized at a, SOFR, which was basically at zero plus 350. So a 3.5% interest rate loan. And now you got to refinance at 6.5% or wherever rates will be next year or the year after. I mean, if you bought that with 75% leverage, you probably need to pay that loan down to like 50% LTV in a lot of these Sunbelt markets. And so not a lot of owners are going to be willing to do that or able to do it. So I think there's going to be a lot of deals for sale in the next year or two in the markets where floating rate borrowing was prevalent. So really just the entire Sunbelt from coast to coast in the South. And then also too, especially in the places where the operating costs are running against you and rents flattened out. So thinking about like in Florida and some of these other places where they've had insurance go from $300-$400 a unit to, $2,000 a unit. And well, rents are flat and then your interest rate's going up. And so I think, people are going to have tough decisions where they're going to need to make capital calls or, take on another partner or just sell at a break even or a loss. But I think at some point, right now I need this deal that I've saw that's in that scenario. It has not sold at distressed pricing, where there's so few things for sale today and this year, transaction volume had dropped so much that those deals still get good action on them and get, 10, 20 offers on a building. So I think in order for prices like to really drop from the distress, there'll need to be a flood of deals for sale. And I guess it remains to be seen if when and if that happens, but there is a lot of distress in the market because of the interest rates and operating costs. But I think on the positive, once you get to the backside of that, so talking 2 years from now, 2025, 3 years from now, 2026, it's going to be an amazing time for multifamily. And right now, there's a lot of new supply being built, but there's nothing new coming behind that. It's impossible right now nearly to get development equity with how high interest rates are and how high cap rates moved. It doesn't make sense at today's building costs to build something. And then with, an interest rate in on a construction loan, those are predominantly floating rate. So, SOFR plus, 300-400%. I mean, that gives you an 8-9% interest rate so development deals are not penciling now. And so what that means is, in 2025 and 2026, there's not going to be any new apartment buildings being delivered. Obviously there's going to be some, but compared to what it is now, it's going to seem like nothing. And in these places that are still growing, like Phoenix, like Dallas, like Austin, like Florida, even though I'm saying they're going to have some near-term trouble, it's going to then, I think, just boom, right back up with rent growth and interest rates falling. So I think, I don't think we get back to like 3% interest rates again, but even if interest rates go, let's say to 5%, that would really, really put the market in a great place, and you'd be seeing rent growth by then. So I think the name of the game, I mean, everyone's been saying survive till 25, but when you really think of like what's going on behind that, like it makes a lot of sense. Maybe now interest rates staying higher for longer might be survive till 2026, but it's going to be a couple choppy years here, followed by a couple really great years. So I like it, you know, for, so anything we're looking at today would be a 5 to 10 year hold, knowing the next couple of years could be tough, but, you'd be coming out of that with, you know, every tailwind, sort of at your back.
And, you know, kind of, piggybacking on that, it is challenging right now with transaction velocity being lower, to be an investor in multifamily. How is Brenneman looking to navigate those challenges? Is it through capital sourcing? Are you getting creative with partnership structuring? You know, how are you finding and sourcing deals and continuing to move in this, you know, challenging environment?
We really haven't changed much. I think we're just going to stay steady at what we do. We finally just put a deal in Chicago under LOI, and we had not bought anything for almost a year and a half. And so we went back and looked, we underwrote 430 deals in the last year and a half. And so if that's the work it takes, that's what it's going to take to buy one. And so I don't think we haven't changed, haven't changed anything really, just need to stay disciplined. And then like the deals will come in time is how I think, where I don't want to be chasing things going, okay, let's just meet the market and pay. Cause I think, you know, there may be more, you know, this deal, I like the pricing today where I'm not as worried about what the next year looks like for this particular deal. But in some of these places, it's like, it looks like it could be tougher in a year. And I think in the size we play in that $5 to $50 million space, that most all of the deals still sell with a broker attached to them, you know, or some competitive form of marketing, you know, putting it on, you know, Craigslist or something, or with a broker. We're not just doing, like we have not done much direct mail or direct owner outreach. It seems like most of these bigger deals don't sell that way. Not that that wouldn't work, but that just hasn't been something that we've done. It seems like kind of the best way to find the deals is being tight with a broker and getting off market looks and then performing. And then maybe that same owner has other things to sell, but they still want to get that broker's input, and bring it to you. So.
Right. And then how are you navigating that spread between seller expectations and, you know, where you'd like to be? Are you seeing that instead of just meeting the market, are sellers starting to step down at a greater clip to kind of meet where you are, as opposed to you stepping up to where they are?
I'm seeing we're not moving up in price, and I'm not seeing sellers really moving down much. I mean, there's still a very big bid ask spread. You know, if I had to say, like on those 430 deals we looked at, what was the spread? I mean, it was probably on average, it would have been around 10 or 12%. So like a big difference. But what seems like what happened on every one of those deals is there was someone on the buy side still willing to get aggressive. Somebody sitting on money. Wow. And when I say getting aggressive, I mean, they're still buying at maybe 20% below what the price would have been a year and a half ago. So like they can justify it as right. It's a great basis. It's that we're buying it at replacement cost or below replacement cost, or like they have a rationale that it potentially will work. I mean, if you can, especially you're going to own it longer term, like this, you know, prices pull back 20%, let's say, in that given market, and that basis alone, like the investment could make sense where you're buying that much cheaper. But usually someone has stepped up enough where we look at it and go like, wow, I can't believe somebody's still paying that. Cause maybe we underwrote it and we want to make, you know, typically like a 15 or 16 gross IRR on the deal, 5-year hold. And then we'll type in what they're paying and it's spits out the model like an 8% IRR. And we're like, wow, why would they do that? But obviously they probably have different assumptions than us. Maybe they're more aggressive on their rents or rent growth or interest rates or something. So the sellers are stepping down some, but it's not like, okay, hey, we're here, we're 12% below where they want to be. And then they just meet it because they're so worried about the future. And no, I mean, a lot of right. them, the thing that is good and bad about multifamily is, you know, the resident base, the income, it's very well diversified. So, you know, to have a distressed seller, it's almost like you need to have something wrong with the way they set up the deal, like with these loan issues we're talking about, or a problem with the partnership. It's rarely like the actual property, where in retail and office, these other ones, yeah, you can have an office building empty out, and that could have been the, they could have put the greatest loan on that ever and can be the best partnership imaginable, but the property is doing poorly. So you don't have any forced selling because of that. So then the sellers, they don't have to, they don't need to maybe meet the market as much as how it seemed. But if all of a sudden now there's a tidal wave of, you know, 2021 loans maturing in 2024, maybe it's different next year, but at least that's how our entire 2023 has gone so far. So,
well, moving on to our last topic here, given your specialized background and experience, sure, our listeners would be curious about your answers to a few of our rapid fire questions and words of advice. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. So if you were given $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would your go-to asset type and location be, and why?
I'd be waiting for these, you know, a year from now kind of Sunbelt opportunities for, you need the sellers to kind of come down to where I'm talking now, where, you know, the deals are penciling to mid-teen IRRs. And then I would be, you have $50 million to put to work. I would focus on like nicer vintage properties in the growth market. So let's say stuff built after 1990, multifamily in these markets that are growing. So since from when I first started, like in 2005, it was all about the gateway markets, you know, New York. It was every time you open up a research report from a brokerage house, it was like, what's number one, New York or San Francisco? It just flip-flopped. Now it's like, what's number one, Dallas or Phoenix or Miami? And I think that's going to continue. And so I would be trying to buy the nicer properties that would be selling at a large discount compared to 2 years ago in the Sun Belt.
Favorite tool or software that you use on the job? This is not a trick question.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody says Excel, but I think one thing I'll give a shout out to Red IQ. So we use that, and that what that does is they it takes a rent roll in and the past financials. It could be in any format, a PDF or anything, and using AI and our own manual adjustments, it puts it in the format we use to underwrite, and then you can export it to Excel, which then we can dump right into our model. So, and I think it's not a trick question because of course we all love Crexie. So I have a couple deals for sale right now in Chicago that should be up on Crexie. The broker promised me they'd be up on there, so I need to double check myself. But so it's
And then what is the most common misconception about your job or industry?
It's a good question. I think probably people on the outside maybe think it's like really stressful, you know, and it's like high pressure. I would say, like, I think it's one thing that's interesting with real estate is like things develop quite slowly. I mean, a lot of the answers I'm explaining what might happen 3 years from now. So a lot of this, it's not like trading stocks where people are like around, you know, you think of the thing like it's things are happening that fast. Like there's a lot of time to evaluate and sort of make decisions. Even the process to buy a property, you know, takes a couple months. So I think probably people on the outside think it's almost like, you know, we're trading stocks here or something, a high pressure, a quick thing. And it's everything's very slow to develop. You need to be very patient to invest in real estate. It's definitely a long-term game.
Got it. Well, I appreciate your time. As we wrap up, any parting words you want to share with our audience?
No, I think, I mean, if people are interested in finding out more about Brenneman Capital, I mean, you can go to our website, you know, Brenneman.com. I think that's, you know, a good way to get in touch. You know, I have my podcast, The Brenneman Blueprint. It's a real estate investing podcast. You know, so I have kind of get into this kind of stuff on that. And then I think not, you know, if you're thinking parting words on the market or anything, no, I think this was a great interview. I think you did a good job with the questions. I got, you know, a lot of things I've never, you know, haven't talked about before. So this was just a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, sharing your insights. I know you're really busy, and we appreciate you spending the time to sit down with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexie.com/podcast. That's go.crexie.com/podcast. And sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexie podcast on your favorite podcast app
or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/Crexy for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, we'll see you next time.